You're listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 10, Kerensky's Farce. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades, and welcome back. Last episode, we saw the Bolsheviks fall to their lowest point of the revolution, but then pull off a comeback that would make most sport teams jealous. And we left on a bit of a teaser about an existential threat that was looming on the horizon. Today, we will examine just where that threat would come from. The discussion about the threat itself will take place next time. This episode is all about how this threat became almost an inevitability. To start, we are actually going to go back to mid-July, at the height of the reaction against the Bolsheviks we talked about last episode. On the 16th, now Prime Minister Kerensky called a meeting of the head generals of the Russian army. In attendance at this meeting were a handful of government officials accompanying Kerensky, and generals Brusilov, Alexeyev, Ruzsky, Klimbovsky, Denikin, and Romanovsky. There was one general who had been invited but was absent, as he was at that moment dealing with the disastrous rollback of his armies by the Germans along the southwestern front in the final gasps of the June offensive. One of his tactics to inspire his men to fight? Open fire on them if they retreated. This general's name? Lavr Georgievich Kornilov. The generals who were at the meeting with Kerensky took the opportunity to air their grievances against not only the revolution in general, but against the new head of the government personally. They lamented the collapse of discipline and morale among the soldiers that had occurred since February, and took aim specifically at the formation of various committees and Soviets, both in the military ranks and in positions of authority over the army. General Alexeyev insisted the revolution was at fault, saying, quote, "Military history, consisting of millennia, has given us its laws. We wanted to violate them, and so we have suffered a fiasco," end quote. His recommendation was clear. All existing institutions of popular control over military affairs must be abolished immediately, and control of the military must be handed back over entirely to the generals. But as Trotsky points out in his History of the Russian Revolution, such scapegoating of the revolution and the socialists for the military disasters of 1917 were craven excuses which ignored all of the military disasters of the Imperial Army in 1914, 15, and 16, which these very men had overseen. He cites reports from some of the generals present at this very meeting to the Tsar and military headquarters that they simply did not have the means to win the war, reports dating as early as 1915. But that did not stop the generals from attempting to shift all the blame to the Soviets and the socialists in them, or from insisting that Kerensky himself was screwing everything up. For his part, Kerensky rather slavishly allowed the generals to berate him. Trotsky quotes Kerensky from records of the meeting as saying about the Declaration of Soldiers' Rights, that is, Order Number 1, quote, "If I had been minister at the time it was being worked out, the declaration would not have been released," end quote. This meeting between the government and the military is important for three reasons. One, it shows how counter-revolutionary the high command of the Russian army was, as well as how unbelievably lacking they were of any self-awareness. After years of military failures, they were all too happy to blame everything on the workers and peasants who dared to speak up on their own behalves, which begs the question, if the Tsar had still been around, whom would they have blamed then? Two, this is just one of many examples to be found of Kerensky's weakness of character. In offering zero pushback against the general's obviously self-serving narrative, he failed to defend not only himself, but the soldiers, workers, and those who were supposed to be his fellow socialists by throwing them all under the bus, or I guess the tank in this instance. And three, at the end of the meeting, the decision was made to name in absentia General Kornilov as the new commander-in-chief of the entire Russian army. Kornilov had been one of the loudest voices clamoring for the right to execute his soldiers as he saw fit to be returned to him, before the death penalty was reinstated, which we know from last episode happened on the 12th of July. Of course, there were more than a few nervous voices from the left who expressed, shall we say, trepidation at the power Kornilov was now being given. But in a galling perversion of revolutionary ideas, Kerensky promised up and down that Kornilov would save the revolution, that he was possessed of, quote, Republican sympathies, and that he was a, quote, friend of the committees and commissars. Uh-huh, sure. And I saw my neighbor Ivan's pig flying just last night. Kornilov had been notified of his new position as commander-in-chief in a telegram, to which the general had replied with an ultimatum. He would accept the new position only under the conditions of, quote, my responsibility only to my own conscience and to the people, no interference in my naming of the upper army command, and the reinstating of the death penalty in the army rear, end quote. This last part sounded rather ominous. Well, I mean, the whole thing sounded ominous, but the last part in particular was in reference to the fact that the death penalty had thus far been reinstated only at the front. Why he would insist on reinstating the death penalty in the rear? Well, I'll let you ponder that one out yourself, dear listener. Kerensky, showing just the tiniest amount of a spine, probably because this was all being said over telegram wire and not face-to-face, insisted on clarification of Kornilov's words, pushing back just enough to eventually force the general to declare that by, quote, responsibility to the people, he of course meant responsibility to the government. The general's ultimatum and later clarification were published in the cadet paper Reich, which means speech. And despite some grumblings from some quarters who were shockingly not reassured by Kerensky's promises regarding Kornilov's, quote, Republican sympathies, ultimately, his conditions were accepted, and his appointment as commander-in-chief was made official. So now that Kornilov is officially a player on the revolutionary chessboard, let's take a beat to talk about him. Alexander Rabinowitch, in The Bolsheviks Come to Power, The Revolution of 1917 in Petrograd, describes Kornilov's appearance, quote, short, lean, noticeably bandy-legged in stature, straightforward, and tough in manner. Kornilov was distinguished by his narrow beard, his thick, graceful mustache, and the slanted eyes and high cheekbones of his Mongolian forebears, end quote. Kornilov was born in 1870 to a Cossack family in Siberia, and by the time of World War I had put together an impressive military career, having served in the Russo-Japanese War. Politically, Kornilov was very unsophisticated. Trotsky himself says he was, quote, of the Black Hundreds variety, end quote. And he quotes General Alexeyev as calling Kornilov, quote, an absolute ignoramus in the realms of politics, end quote. And, quote, a man with the heart of a lion and the brains of a sheep, end quote. But what most recommended him for the historical role he is about to play was that he was known by all as a strict, almost savage disciplinarian, as if that wasn't already obvious from his open eagerness for the right to kill his own soldiers. As happens so often in politics throughout human history, people began to imprint on someone they saw as their savior their own hopes and dreams for the future. In this case, the ruling classes began to believe that if only they could bring discipline back into fashion in the military and the civilian leadership, the numerous crises facing the nation could be resolved in their favor. And every day, more and more members of those ruling classes were becoming comfortable with the idea of Kornilov employing extreme measures in order to secure this outcome. Liberal cadets and business and landowners shifted more and more to the right, talking openly about how maybe a military dictatorship would be the answer to their problems. We already know the generals wanted to end the revolution and reassert their control over the military situation, but this sentiment was found throughout the officer corps, including members of military organizations like the Union of Officers of the Navy and Army and the Military League. Of course, the peasant question is still looming throughout all of this. Even though I do not mention it every episode, never forget that the countryside of Russia is a powder keg, with demands for land reform thundering from every district and region, and peasant patience running out, with more and more peasants taking matters into their own hands as time passes. This explains why the landowners would be so keen for a military takeover. As for the civilian population, the petty bourgeoisie and bourgeoisie were devastated and angered by the resurgence of the Bolsheviks in late July and through August. They were no less distressed by the military situation than the officers, although for different reasons. As we discussed two episodes back, the ruling classes were in a situation where they had to win the war, even though the war was unwinnable. And when the wise military leaders in whom the ruling classes had entrusted the war effort scapegoated the revolution, the Bolsheviks, and the masses for screwing everything up, the bourgeoisie were more than willing to accept this version of events and believe that a strong man could be the answer to all their problems. It is here that we are going to take a brief tangent so I can correct what has been a rather glaring oversight thus far in the show. In episode 1, The Phantom Red Menace, I shockingly never actually defined or even mentioned the term petty bourgeoisie. And then, starting in episode 2, Lenin talks about the petty bourgeoisie constantly, and I just went with it, never actually circling back around to explain who or what they are. This is an embarrassing oversight on my part, and I apologize. It happened because the Marx episode was absolutely jam-packed. So jam-packed, in fact, that I was running up against the recording time limit in GarageBand. And then after that, the term is so second nature to me personally that I totally forgot it needed a definition. I imagine some of you listening are either familiar enough with socialist writings to know what that term means, or have guessed from context clues. But for anyone out there who still does not know what we mean when we say petty bourgeoisie, I'm going to take a brief detour to explain. As we have seen, this subsection of the bourgeoisie has already been quite important throughout the revolutionary period. As it turns out, they will be quite important throughout the entirety of the existence of the Soviet Union. The petty bourgeoisie are, in basic terms, the small business owner class. The petty bourgeoisie, or the small business owners, whichever term you prefer, have managed to plant a stake on the owners of the means of production side of the class divide. Hence, they are bourgeoisie. But that stake is very small and very tenuous. Hence, they are petty. So, no, we don't mean petty in the sense of caring only about small, trivial, material things, but as a synonym for small. Although, come to think of it, I'm sure a lot of them do in fact care about the trivial things. Huh. In fact, I guess you could say the petty bourgeoisie really is pretty petty. Oh god, I'm so sorry. Even if they start with, say, just one store or factory and eventually open up one or two more locations, the petty bourgeoisie is still very far away from the final boss status of the full-grown bourgeoisie, who command entire industries and or large portions of the market, and have maybe even achieved the mythical status of too big to fail. Don't get me wrong, the petty bourgeoisie definitely exploit their employees' labor by virtue of their control over some small amount of the means of production. Nearly all of them wind up intensely exploiting their own labor by working long hours and foregoing a salary, at least in the beginning. But despite all this, small business owners are, in reality, still just one or two bad business cycles away from losing whatever status and privilege they've managed to carve out for themselves. If their business goes under, boom, they are back on the proletarian side of the class divide, and are again faced with being exploited in order to provide for their material needs. This, as you can imagine, fills a lot of them with anxiety, which, from a human standpoint, is pretty understandable. Capitalism is a brutal system that pits all of us against each other and engenders whatever the opposite of class solidarity is. In a world where everyone is just clawing to keep from being on the bottom of the pile and crushed by said pile, it is completely understandable that if you manage to elevate yourself to a level even just a little above the worst of the fray, you don't want to fall back down there. So in a way, the petty bourgeoisie can be somewhat sympathetic. However, in practice, the petty bourgeoisie, when the chips are down and it's time to pick a side, almost always side with the bourgeoisie. The reasons for this are varied, complex, and specific to whatever time and place you look at. This has been a long enough tangent, so we won't get into that here. I will instead end by saying the nature of the petty bourgeoisie is paradoxical. In the short run, their interests are served by siding with the bourgeoisie and capital, in the hopes of not backsliding and possibly even making progress vis-a-vis other members of their class. This, again, is a somewhat sympathetic position. But in the long run, they would be more secure in their material needs by siding with the proletariat and doing away with capitalism and the bourgeoisie altogether, since that would erase a lot of the anxiety they feel about losing what little they have. But whatever sympathy the petty bourgeoisie manages to elicit for their all-too-human anxieties is negated by the fact that, as a group, 99% of the time, they would rather sell out the masses to save their own hides. Which is exactly why, you might have noticed, Lenin has been speaking of them in rather scathing terms. Before we move on, though, one last thing I want to mention is that the question of whether it is worth expending energy and resources on trying to win over the small business owners to the side of the proletariat has been asked for centuries and is still asked today. For my money, one of the main reasons I think this question keeps coming up is because the promise of what could happen if the solidarity of the bourgeois class was ever successfully undermined and the petty bourgeoisie were won over to the side of the proletariat is simply too tantalizing. Such a development would practically ensure the success of a workers' revolution. But, as we will see throughout the remainder of our episodes on the Russian Revolution, this hope, just like in the myth of Tantalus himself, is always and forever just out of reach, and the workers' movement is better served by simply accepting this fact. Just think about the SRs and Mensheviks. In episode 7, The People and the Party, I touched on how the SR leadership was actually more representative of the wealthier stratum of the peasant class, that is, the small and medium-sized farmholders, or the petty bourgeois stratum of the peasantry. This left the laboring peasants to feel neglected and abandoned. For their part, the Mensheviks have always represented the more well-off workers and small business owners who were afraid to lose what little they had if the madness of the revolution was not curbed, which is why they succumbed so quickly to the opportunism about which Lenin warned. We have already seen how they behaved during and after the July days, and how they sided with the bourgeoisie. Trust me when I tell you, this phenomenon is not unique to the Russian Revolution. It is, in fact, observed time and again, regardless of era and geographic location. Like I say, the workers are better off just accepting this fact and relying on themselves. Fortunately, we are getting very close to seeing just how successful such an approach can be. But okay, how's that for a brief tangent? If you are enjoying this show, and you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. I have been thinking of how best to show my appreciation for my supporters, and I have a few different ideas in the works. Early access on Patreon, without mid-show plugs like this, is definitely coming soon. But that's not all. Once we get past the revolutionary period and the Civil War, there will be polling to help me figure out what subjects you want me to cover. I even have an ambitious plan to bring the voices of still-living Soviet citizens to the show. I haven't quite worked everything out yet, but I am very excited at this and a few other ideas. So please, head over to patreon.com/sovietpod to support the show. Also, please leave a rating and review on whatever platform you are using. And please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. Before we move on to the farce to which the title of this episode alludes, I want to take a beat to check in with our good friend Kerensky. Poor little Alexander is having quite a go of it now that he's prime minister. As the new head of the provisional government, Kerensky was looked to for a solution to the Bolshevik menace. He straddled the line of dual power for the entirety of the revolution. He had been elected vice chairman of the Petrosoviet in March, but had also been a minister in the government since the overthrow of the Tsar. As such, Kerensky was practically the embodiment of the contradictions of dual power. I mentioned in episode 3, Cast of Characters, that he wasn't a particularly gifted politician, but maybe that wasn't entirely fair. He did have a knack for playing both sides, of satisfying, or I guess it would be more accurate to say that he was able to keep at bay, both the more popular and radical demands of the Petrosoviet and the more reactionary demands of the bourgeoisie and the Cadet Party. As long as both sides believed Kerensky was in their corner, they supported him. And his true gift as a politician lie in being able to convince everyone he was in specifically their corner. But this is exactly why Kerensky was doomed from the beginning. He was tasked with satisfying the needs of two classes, but those needs were mutually exclusive. For example, as Trotsky says about the June offensive, which, remember, was also called the Kerensky offensive since he was the Minister of War at the time, quote, "The offensive which raised Kerensky's reputation in the ranks of the bourgeoisie conclusively undermined his popularity with the people. The failure of the offensive was, in essence, the failure of Kerensky in both camps. But amazingly, his ability to compromise with both sides made him irreplaceable." End quote. There really was nobody else that could walk the tightrope as well as Kerensky. And since both sides needed him to try to maintain a truce between the Soviets and the government, despite colossal screw-ups and a lack of vision, no one was able to get rid of him. Well, until Lenin, that is, but we'll get there in due time. Given that Kerensky was split between both sides of dual power, we maybe should not be surprised that, when it came to General Kornilov, the Prime Minister was straddling yet another divide. Publicly, he supported the general as the new commander-in-chief, in large part because he had to. Kornilov was immediately very popular with the monarchists, the army command, business interests, liberals, pretty much everyone whose favor Kerensky needed to retain in order to keep the Second Coalition government intact. But Kerensky was also acutely aware that Kornilov presented a threat to him personally. If the commander became too popular, he might decide to do away with Kerensky altogether and take control of the country. Not to mention that Kornilov's ultimata before accepting the post of commander-in-chief, and his insistence that he only be held accountable to his own conscience, had basically telegraphed to Kerensky that Kornilov did not intend on playing nice with the politicians. Kerensky did try to float the idea of replacing or annulling Kornilov's appointment, but the general was simply too popular with too many special interest individuals and groups for Kerensky to be able to risk upsetting the applecart at that point. But in case anyone out there was missing the obvious, that almost from the beginning Kerensky and Kornilov were on a collision course, the event that took place in mid-August of our fateful year metaphorically slapped everyone upside the head so hard they snapped to attention and were no longer missing the obvious. We come now to the farce that was the Moscow State Conference. The conference was held from the 12th to the 15th of August at the Bolshoi Theater and was ostensibly called to discuss the political situation in the country and to consolidate governmental power. That is, Kerensky was hoping to get everyone at the conference on the same page and pulling in the same direction. This goal was to be achieved by allowing all the various groups and interests to speak their minds in addressing the government and each other, at which point, I don't know, I guess Kerensky hoped a swell of patriotism would compel everyone to put their differences aside and work together for the common good? Who knows? The conference was attended by a wide swath of people and groups. There were Duma officials, industrial, business, and financial groups, and also attendance from almost all the major political parties and representatives of the Soviets and labor groups. I say almost all the major political parties, because the Bolsheviks, as a party, were absent. This occurred because it became known that the Bolshevik representatives from the Soviets were planning a protest and walkout on the opening day of the conference, which threatened to hijack what I'm sure everyone was convinced would be a somber and stately affair. The other quote-unquote socialist parties in the Soviet, holding the majority, responded by voting that any party, group, or individual who did this would be expelled from the All-Russian Executive Committee of the Soviets. Faced with the choice of either meeting expectations for behavior at the conference or being expelled from the Soviets, the Bolsheviks went with option C. They boycotted the conference altogether. Some individual Bolsheviks attended as representatives of smaller Soviets and independent labor groups, but the party itself had no presence. At the conference itself, the split between right and left was numerically fairly even. despite the fact that the right in the general population of the country represented a small minority, and so by giving them roughly half the number of attendees, the right was being disproportionately represented. Also, the left that was represented at the conference was, without the Bolsheviks, the conciliatory left of the SRs and Mensheviks, who had shown for the last several weeks where their priorities and loyalties lie. The general atmosphere in Moscow leading up to the conference was tense, as rumors swirled that Kornilov would move troops on the old capital of medieval Rus. The threat was taken so seriously that the Moscow Soviet formed a six-man provisional revolutionary committee with two Bolsheviks, two Mensheviks, and two SRs that was to coordinate efforts to repel any attempts at a military coup. But the rumors proved to be unfounded this time. The conference opened as scheduled, and just as at the National Assembly of the French Revolution some 120 years prior, where the political divide of right and left originated, the supporters of the government, generals, and business interests sat on the right side of the Great Hall, while the socialists, labor interests, and Soviet representatives sat on the left. Many speeches from both sides of the political divide were made. References were made to enemies of the revolution and threats to democracy, rhetoric that everyone understood to be aimed at the Bolsheviks. Kerensky opened the conference on the 12th with a speech in which he tried to assert his dominance over both the extreme left and extreme right of the revolution. When he said that any new attempts at infringing on official state power would, quote, be stopped with iron and blood, end quote, thunderous applause rang throughout the hall, and everyone knew that he was speaking directly to and about the Bolsheviks. When, however, he also promised that, quote, whosoever might present me whatever ultimata, I will succeed in subordinating him to the will of supreme power, and to me, its supreme leader, end quote. This was an unmistakable assertion that Kerensky, not Kornilov, was the head honcho, and everyone present better not forget it. To which only about half the hall, the half occupied by the socialist parties and labor representatives, cheered. The half occupied by the military forces and their supporters sat in silence. Speaking of Kornilov, the general arrived from the front on the 14th and gave his address, in which he repeated the by now all too familiar refrain of blaming the failures of the army on the revolution. He said, quote, this army was turned by a whole host of legislative measures driven after the revolution by people alien to the spirit and understanding of the army into a most mindless crowd, which values exclusively its own life, end quote. He vowed also to deal with the anarchy running rampant in the ranks with the strictest measures. Quote, the conclusions of history and combat experience demonstrate that without discipline, there is no army. Only an army forged in iron discipline, only an army led by the singular, unyielding will of its leader, only such an army is capable of victory and deserving of victory. Only such an army can endure all the trials of combat. End quote. And these are just two quotes. The gist of Kornilov's address to the conference was basically this. But there is one thing we should note that was missing from this speech. Kornilov did not present at the conference, nor anywhere else in any of his other public appearances or documents, any sort of unified political program. His only real goal was to restore discipline in the army and win the war. To the extent Kornilov had a political program, it was actually crafted and pushed by his underlings, and we'll take a closer look at that next time. For now, it is enough to remember that before, during, and after the commander-in-chief spoke, even as he was approaching the rostrum, thunderous applause rang out, but this time only from the right side of the hall. Other speakers included still more generals who echoed the new commander-in-chief's sentiments and vows to restore discipline in the ranks, as well as calling for the abolition of the Soviets as institutions, claiming they were the source of the anarchy in the army. In response, individuals from the left, such as Tseretelli and Chechidze, also spoke, promising to defend the Soviets and demanding an end to the war. A full accounting of the back and forth of speeches is not necessary. But we can imagine that far from engendering a sense of governmental unity, the back and forth presentations across the political spectrum, filled with sharp words and threats of both the thinly veiled and open variety, only heightened tensions. By the end of the conference, the polarized nature of dual power was on full display for everyone to see, and no amount of papering over by Kerensky could hide it. But wait! As if all this was not already facepalm-worthy enough, let's check in with the Bolsheviks. If you thought they were just sitting around with popcorn watching the drama of the conference unfold, you have not been paying attention to who the Bolsheviks are. Leading up to the conference, after announcing their boycott, the Party of the Workers managed to drum up support for a wildcat strike to take place on the opening day of the conference. For anyone unfamiliar with the term wildcat strike, it is a term used, at least in the United States, to describe a strike that was called without the official endorsement of some authority that was supposed to lend an air of officialdom to the strike itself. In this case, the authority that voted down the strike was the joint session of the Moscow Workers and Soldiers Soviets. However, the strike was supported by the Bolshevik Party, as well as labor unions across the city. And so, while government officials, representatives of the conciliatory socialists, and reactionary generals were yelling at each other inside the Bolshoi Theater, outside, on the streets of the city, the workers of Moscow were making their presence, or rather their absence, felt. Restaurants and cafes were closed, streetcars and taxis sat idle, factories were silent, and the waiters and chefs hired to serve the conference did not show. Even the lamplighters stayed home, so that by that evening, the Moscow streetlights were dark, creating what must have been an eerie and ominous atmosphere. The juxtaposition of these two scenes that week in Moscow, government officials and their allies in the Soviets generating a lot of impotent noise, while the workers directly exercised their power in calm silence, could not have highlighted any better the absurdity and bluster of the provisional government. This was immediately obvious to the Bolsheviks. Trotsky said of the state conference, quote, "The Moscow State Conference ended in a predetermined failure. It created nothing. It decided nothing," end quote. He repeatedly refers to the conference as a piece of theater, obviously punning on the physical location of the conference. And it's hard to argue with that. We have grand promises of forging a new way forward for the provisional government, promises that evaporate in the heat of the rhetoric between the right and the left. Instead of the unity that Kerensky had professed to be seeking, everyone departed the conference more on edge and divided over what to do than ever before. Meanwhile, Moscow had witnessed a general strike that was whipped up by the one party not in attendance at the conference. The strike sent the unmistakable message that the workers as a class were only becoming more unified as time went on. But amazingly, this message had completely gone over the heads of the conference attendees, who were too engrossed in their own clown show to notice what was going on. Truly, this moment, maybe more than any other singular moment between February and October 1917, gives the sense that, were this pitched as the script of a movie, it would be rejected out of hand for being far too absurd and on the nose. But the most important consequence of the conference became clear only in light of the events that took place roughly 2 weeks after its conclusion. You see, there was one issue upon which almost everyone who had attended the conference now kind of agreed. The left came away convinced a military coup was being planned, while the right came away convinced that a military coup was now the only way forward. And of course, at the tippy top of the governmental period, there were now two figures instead of one. The civilian, Alexander Kerensky, and the general, Lavr Kornilov. Both had just spoken publicly about their intent to bend the other to his will. And this tension that the existence of two figureheads had in the provisional government would be resolved in short order. But trust me when I say, if you thought the Moscow conference was absurdism in the flesh, wait until you hear about Kornilov's attempted coup. Thank you so much for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. Any amount helps and is greatly appreciated. This entire project is run only by me in my spare time, and in practicing my anti-capitalist values, I will never run ads. So regular contributions allow me to devote more time, energy, and resources to making the show the best it can be. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. If you'd like to get in touch, you can write me at sovietpod@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.